Well, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me very real pleasure to welcome you to another in the series of our centennial lectures, and particular pleasure to this lecture this evening by Williamson Murray, one of the foremost, I think it's fair to say, students, current students of military strategy and history. He received his, Professor Murray received his PhD from Yale in 1975 after service in Southeast Asia as an Air Force officer. After teaching at Yale, he went to Ohio State University, where he remained until his retirement this spring, when we were able to tempt him to come to the LSE. He's been many things: Secretary of the Navy, Fellow at the Royal, at the Naval War College. You wouldn't have a Royal College, would you, in the US? And has just been appointed as the Horner Professor of Strategy at the Marine Corps University in Virginia. He's the author, amongst other things, of The Change in the European Balance of Power, the Luftwaffe, indeed the standard text on, I think, now on the history of the Luftwaffe, and German military effectiveness. And he and Professor McGregor Knox, the Stevenson Professor at the LSE, were the editors of The Making of Strategy, Rulers, States, and War. His book on the air war in the Gulf is scheduled to be published next month, but I guess we're going to be privileged to have a peek at it. So without more ado, can I invite Professor Williamson Murray to talk to us on the air war in the Gulf, the limits of technological war.
Very kind introduction. It is an honor to give this lecture as a centennial visiting professor, and to particularly to have been a member of a department that calls itself the Department of International History, a unique and proud title, especially to an American who has watched American universities flee from the study of international history in favor of the study of race, gender, and other politically correct topics. And my effort today involves an attempt to place the 1991 Gulf campaign, Gulf Air War campaign, within a larger context, the context of air war in the 20th century. In its immediate aftermath, the Gulf War received great attention. Stunning videos provided by the United States Air Force and the Royal Air Force, even while the combat crews were deconstructing Iraq, presented images that remain with us today. Bombs disappearing down air conditioning shafts of Iraqi Air Force headquarters, bridges collapsing at the first go, hardened aircraft shelters built to withstand the effects of nuclear weapons being smashed, and finally the huddled, helpless equipment of the Iraqi army being blown to smithereens. To many, particularly in the United States Air Force, it appeared that air power with such capabilities and accuracy had at last come of age, reaching the promises of Douay, Trenchard, and Mitchell. In the conflict's immediate aftermath, even critics of the United States Air Force exclaimed that Desert Storm was, quote, probably the most frictionless war we have ever fought. In fact, it was not. The idea that any human affair, much less war, involving hundreds of thousands of individuals can take place without friction is indeed bizarre. What I propose to do then is to place the Gulf War within a larger context and suggest some observations about both the limitations and actual impact of the air campaign on the course of the war. Let me begin by saying a few words about the early theories of air power. Those enunciated by Douay, Trenchard, Mitchell, and the instructors of the U.S. Army's Air Corps Tactical School, because I believe that those theories and ideas have exercised a continuing and generally negative influence over how air power advocates and air forces have thought about their business right up to the present day. From the earliest days of air power theory, three fundamentally flawed beliefs have skewed the capacity of airmen to think about how air power might contribute to the conduct of war. First, it's been a belief that history does not matter. What matters is the technical drive to the future, or in the words of Hollywood, a race back to the future. Second, has been the belief that civil power in one form or another, whether described as popular morale, the industrial web of a nation, or government stability, is more vulnerable than the deployed military power of an opposing state. And third has been the belief that air power brings a simple calculus to the table that allows a military power to avoid the incalculables and frictions that have confronted leaders of armies and navies throughout history. Let me begin by sort of going over these three sort of basic themes in air power and air forces over the past 80 to 90 years. First of all, in terms of the attitude towards history itself. Air power in the interwar theory represented an explicit attempt to move beyond the record and implications of the past. As Britain's air staff pontificated in a memorandum in 1924, a memorandum which I can assure you from my own experiences on the air staff in the mid-1980s could have been written by some of the people I knew in that organization. Air forces employed in attacking an enemy nation, quote, can either bomb military objectives in populated areas from the beginning of the war with the objective of obtaining a decision by morale, effect which such attacks will produce, and by the serious dislocation of the normal life of the country, or alternatively, they can be used in the first instance to attack enemy aerodromes with a view to gaining some degree of air superiority, and when this has been gained, can change over to the direct attack on the nation. The latter alternative is the method which the lessons of military history seem to recommend, but the air staff are convinced, on the basis, of course, of no evidence, that the former is the correct one. Secondly, in terms of my second point, the belief in pre-war theories carried through, indeed, the Second World War is a belief that strategic bombing would have a relatively easy time in attacking enemy morale or industrial production. Again, do not misunderstand me. I have no intention of arguing that in the end, strategic bombing did not have an important effect in contributing to Allied victory in World War II. It did. It played a crucial element in the winning of the Second World War. But the inescapable point is that no matter how militarily effective Allied strategic bombing proved to victory in World War II, it did not cause the collapse of the German political structure through the collapse of morale at home. To the end, Nazi armies continued their bitter resistance in both East and West. The Reich's manifestly hopeless situation exercised little ability to prevent the regime from dragooning or encouraging those within its reach to resist to the last. With the roof collapsing on both population and industry, the Nazis retained their hold over the population until February and March of 1945. As Hitler and Goebbels so often and so correctly had pronounced, there would be no collapse like 1918. Let me move to the third point. Of all the forms of combat, air war has been the most difficult to calculate in terms of its actual impact. That is largely due to the fact that more often than not, its results are indirect, impossible for the attacker to measure while the conflict is occurring, and often difficult to measure even when the conflict is over. As the commanding general of the United States Army Air Forces in World War II suggested, quote, the real effect of our strategic air assaults, unlike that of tactical air attacks, was seldom immediately apparent. Its effect was more like that of a cancer producing internal decay, ultimately resulting in death. The inability to come up with hard measures of effectiveness has more often than not led air forces to look for measures of efficiency rather than effectiveness. The number of tons of bombs dropped, the loss rates of one's own bombers, the losses of enemy fighter aircraft, the percentage growth in force structure, and the number of targets attacked and destroyed have provided measures of efficiency to justify continuation of a particular course of air attack. It has been particularly the destruction of targets that has attracted airmen as the benchmark of their progress. As Bomber Harris suggested to Churchill in November 1943, Bomber Command had almost completely destroyed 19 major German cities with a further 9 damage. He continued his minute, "From the above you will see that the Ruhr is largely out and that much progress has been made towards the elimination of the remaining essential of German power." And he concluded with, "I feel certain that Germany must collapse before this program of targets, which is more than half concluded already, has proceeded much further." The fact, of course, was that Germany only collapsed when the hard heel of Allied ground forces rested in Germany. In the period after World War II, there was, in fact, very little thinking about World War II and the actual impact and course of the air campaign by both historians, military historians, and by air power theorists. Perhaps not surprisingly, because so much of the period from 1945 to 1990 was dominated by fears of nuclear warfare. The result, however, has been a dichotomy, division, if you will, in which on one side we have had the theoretical musings of civilian academics about nuclear war, while airmen have floundered from one conventional conflict to the next. The result in terms of institutional thinking, in terms of air forces, and here I'm particularly referring to the United States Air Force, has been, again, an institutional disregard of history, whether one talks about long-term history, such as the impact of air power in World War I, or the impact of air power in World War II, or the course of the air war in the period from 1965 to 1968 during Rolling Thunder, or the course of air power during the linebackers in 1972. In fact, very much reminds me of that wonderful Dudley Moore, Peter Cook skit called The Frog and the Peach, in which Peter Cook, being the interviewee, was describing the disasters he had had running a restaurant called The Frog and the Peach, in which the two basic menu items were frog a la pêche, a giant frog with a peach in its mouth and boiling Cointreau poured over it, or pêche a la frog, a giant peach brought to your table, boiling Cointreau poured over it, and when you cut it open, tadpoles swim out of it. Long series of disasters, as only Peter Cook could do wonderfully. And at the end of it, Dudley Moore asked, "Well, have you learned from your mistakes?" And Peter Cook drew himself up on the stage, I remember, because I saw the show in New York, and I can remember him drawing himself up and said, yes, he had studied his mistakes in great detail, going over them again and again, and felt fully confident he could repeat every one of them. I'm afraid in terms of the United States Air Force, there in fact has not even been the study of past mistakes. Result of this was that in 1988, when a book, a rather interesting but I think fundamentally flawed book by an Air Force colonel named John Warden appeared, called The Air Campaign appeared, there was, I think, unjustified enthusiasm among all too many airmen. I know John Warden in many ways is a very interesting figure, although perhaps too much of an ideologue for my own intellectual taste. Warden's book, in effect, was a return to the traditional concepts and belief that air power provided a means, now with new technological aids, to strike at the heart of enemy power and avoid, if you will, the outer rings, particularly in terms of traditional Air Force belief, the enemy's military forces. Now, I think where Worden made a major contribution was his belief that, in fact, the technological means had changed the game, although perhaps not the basics in the game, and also Worden's belief that air power represented a capacity now to achieve operational level effects in warfare. Worden's book, and we don't have to go into great detail because what I want to do in my discussion is to emphasize the actual conduct of the air campaign and the planning of the air campaign and connect it back with these three themes that I established at the beginning of the lecture. Worden, nevertheless, I want to emphasize to you, exercised a great influence over it because by 1990 he had become the head of sort of the strategic analysis section in the Pentagon, and from that position was able to influence the actual drawing up of the plans to handle the Iraqi crisis, which the Bush administration, with great enthusiasm, began to do in August of 1990. The initial efforts to draw up a strategic plan came as a result of default. Ninth Air Force, based at Shaw Air Force Base, was the Air Force headquarters for any American deployment to the Middle East. They were charged with the deployment of American forces in August and September. And both as a consequence of the fact that they were very busy in handling the massive deployment of American forces to the Middle East, and because, in fact, they had done no thinking about an independent air campaign, by default, Worden and a rather small section with the Pentagon ended up in charge of planning at least the initial effort to figure out how to attack militarily, if necessary, the Iraqi regime. Result was, by mid-August, they had come up with a proposed series of briefings for President Bush, and their first briefings, among other things, suggested that a massive first-night attack could have the explicit aim of decapitating the Iraqi political leadership and winning the war in a single night. Well, that, even for Worden and the planners, I think, proved a bit over-optimistic. And within the next week, they had come up with a series of additional proposals, largely pushed by Schwarzkopf and Powell, which aimed to bring air power to bear should the Iraqis prove unwilling to accept the American deployment of forces to the Middle East and should they attack Saudi Arabia. These plans aim to conduct powerful and focused air attacks on the enemy's centers of gravity. The air offensive would involve round-the-clock operations against leadership, strategic air defense, electrical targets with the aim of achieving, quote, strategic paralysis and air superiority. What is interesting is that even after some criticism, about over-optimism, that these plans, for Instant Thunder, which was its code name, believed that one could have a successful air campaign against the Iraqi regime that would only last 5 or 6 days. The end state, very clearly, would be an Iraqi collapse, and while it's not directly stated, an implicit belief that, in fact, Saddam Hussein's regime would collapse before either a military or popular coup and be replaced in relatively short order by, quote, intelligent Iraqi military officers. Part of the reason for the over-optimism was that U.S. intelligence, which had not looked at Iraq in 50 years, from what I can tell, had managed to come up with only 84 major targets. By early January, the number of major targets which U.S. intelligence had identified, with some considerable help from people who actually knew something about the area, had expanded to somewhere well over 300. And as we've discovered since the war was over, from the UN and its efforts to inspect Iraq's nuclear capabilities, that in fact we only managed to identify approximately half of the Iraqi nuclear targets. The issue here is not so much, however, as a lack of accurate target intelligence, as the general underestimation by the airmen, and I think we can say by a number of the other military men as well, and politicians, of the political stability of the Iraqi regime, and the extreme overestimation of Iraqi military forces on the basis of Iraq's success in the Iran-Iraq war, which covered most of the 1980s. These miscalculations, which not just airmen had, but ground commanders as well, had several dangerous consequences, I would argue, in the planning of the year campaign, and might even have skewed the results of the war into a Western political defeat. Ironically, Iraq's strengths and weaknesses were the obverse of what U.S. military and intelligence leaders expected. Saddam Hussein had created a merciless and effective political tyranny, one based on a ferocious ideology and one thoroughly imbued with the repressive tools that had made Stalin's regime so effective. This was not a government that could be overthrown by generals worried about the destruction of the nation's infrastructure or prospects of defeat. Only a campaign aimed at undermining Saddam's position by the ruthless application of force, including the occupation of much of the country, would have had much prospect for overthrowing a tyrant. On the other hand, the demands of political survival in Iraq, an Iraq whose history before Saddam had largely been dominated by military coups, was such that the regime placed military competence very low among the priorities of its military commanders. Like Stalin, between 1937 and 1941, Saddam appointed his generals strictly on the basis of political reliability. The results in terms of battlefield competence were quite similar. There was, of course, a second element in terms of the miscalculation of both Worden's approach and then eventually the planners in Saudi Arabia's approach to the war, a belief which postulated, if you will, that the most preferable military campaign would be an air campaign which forced the Iraqi regime into giving up the Kuwaiti theater of operations, the KTO Kuwait, without a ground war. And that had to do with, of course, the political fallout from such an approach, which was not addressed by any of the air commanders, namely that an Iraq, even an Iraq forced to disgorge Kuwait by an air campaign, would be in a position after the war to argue the way Germany in 1919 had argued, that its army had remained unbeaten in the field, capable and willing to fight the Americans, but the Americans had proven too cowardly to fight a real war as opposed to a Nintendo war. The second weakness before the war began, certainly in August, had to do with, of course, the air commander's view on the scene, General Horner, who was placed in command of the theater while Schwarzkopf gathered the forces in Washington. And Horner, looking at the fact that Iraq had substantial forces deployed in Kuwait, which could have launched a major invasion into Kuwait in response to an air campaign, was none too enthusiastic about the fact that there were no ground forces capable of fighting a ground war until really September, early October. As he said, quite literally, we in Centaf could not have issued even speeding tickets to Iraqi tanks as they came rolling down the interstate highway on the East Coast. Let me turn to the conduct of the war. I want to leave some time for questions because I think, again, this reemphasizes, if you will, the kinds of traditional threads in Air Force thinking which skewed the air campaign in a number of important ways. First of all, I think it's worth noting that, and this was not the fault of the airmen, that there was never any clear idea, whether we talk about July or August, or we talk about December or January, as to what exactly the end state of the war was supposed to be. Was it to remove Iraq from Kuwait? Was it to destroy Iraqi ground forces, or was it to remove Saddam Hussein? And in fact, the command, strategic and political direction, both from Washington and within the theater, obfuscate those issues. The air war began, of course, with an enormously successful attack on the Iraqi air defense system, which enabled coalition air forces to wage a 40-day air campaign with, in fact, no threat in the environment within which coalition aircraft flew. Although I think one can suggest that even that had its downside, as General Horner suggested towards the end of the war, that it was not a particularly edifying picture to see Allied air forces, as he said, kicking a tethered goat. The difficulty, of course, came in the impact of air attacks on the Iraqi leadership. And here, in fact, I think a good deal of the preconceptions of airmen in the pre-war period did not work out quite so well. While the defeat of the Iraqi army in the war eventually led to rebellions in both northern and southern Iraq, the center very clearly held. And there were a number of reasons for this. In the political sense, the ambiguities about U.S. and coalition policy towards whether Allied efforts should aim at overthrowing Saddam prevented a clear strategic or operational focus towards that end, and I would argue either in the air war or the ground war. While coalition air forces embarked on considerable psychological efforts to undermine the morale of the Iraqi army in Kuwait, similar efforts were distinctly missing in the attacks on Iraq. Fundamental to all the various ends the coalition air campaign pursued was an emphasis on reducing collateral damage incidental to military attacks, taking special precautions to minimize civilian casualties. Now, in fact, in terms of political consensus within the coalition, that made enormous success. But it was to have a considerable impact on the ability of air commanders to do anything substantial against political stability of the Iraqi regime. Were two incidences, and only two incidences, which I think speaks very well of the kind of war that was conducted, which involved substantial civilian casualties. The first was the RAF attack on the bridge at Nasiriyah. And the second was the USAF F-117 bombing of the Al-Firdaus bunker. Beyond that, in fact, the coalition, outside of putting the lights out in a substantial portion of Iraq, was not able to exercise a great deal of influence on much of anything that happened in Iraq, and particularly among the public. Let me quote for at least a few lines from a diary of an Iraqi woman who lived through the bombing of Baghdad. Just 3 or 4 days, but I think they'll set the tone for the kind of political impact that the bombing did not have. Day one, I woke up at 3 a.m. to exploding bombs and Salvador Dali, my dog, frantically chasing around the house, barking furiously. I went out on the balcony. Salvador was already there, staring up at a sky lit by the most extraordinary fireworks display. Day four, Suez experimenting with a recipe for basturma. The meat in our freezers is thawing, so it's a good thing the weather is cold. In the evening, we cook potatoes in the fireplace. I make a dynamite punch with aquavit, vodka, and fresh orange juice. Day 5. Apparently, people take off for the countryside with their freezers loaded on their pickup trucks and barbecue the food as it defrosts. Only Iraqis could escape from a war carrying freezers full of goodies. Day 7. The worst has happened. We have to drink warm beer. The crucial point here is, I think, that in fact, in terms of what was going on in Baghdad, and my guess is most of the major towns in Iraq, there was virtually no impact that the IRE campaign had, except for the putting out of the lights. American qualms about casualties, however, did have an impact on our capacity to strike at the Iraqi regime itself, which suggests that, in fact, in the future, we may not be able to even attack the political framework of an opponent regime. In mid-February, the IRE planners, having moved through a number of target sets, moved directly over the night of 12-13 February to a focus directly on the command and control system of the Iraqi regime, political as well as military. Over that night, F-117 struck the Air Force headquarters, the Ministry of Defense, the Ba'ath Party headquarters, the Baghdad Directorate of Internal Security, one of the secret police, the Baghdad Directorate of Military Intelligence, another secret police organism, the Iraqi Intelligence Service headquarters, another secret police headquarters, and the Baghdad Presidential Bunker. This bombing represented a direct attempt to open a sustained targeting effort against the mechanisms by which Saddam and the Ba'ath Party controlled the Iraqi people. Unfortunately, it proved to be the last night of the effort, because two bombs dropped by an F-117 hit the Al-Firdaus bunker. Coalition intelligence had identified before the war no less than 25 bunkers, including the Al-Firdaus site, as backup bunkers for major Iraqi intelligence and secret police organizations. In early February, intelligence indicated that one of those bunkers, the Al-Firdaus one, had come online, being run by secret police or that type of organization. Consequently, it found its way onto the target list for 12 and 13 February. What was not known to intelligence was that the Iraqi political elite was also using the bunker as a shelter. It is worth underlining that the Ba'athist regime had not prepared a vast system of shelters for the population of Baghdad, much less Iraq. Those who were in the Al-Firdaus bunker were there because they had political connections. Ironically, they would have been far safer had they sheltered in their homes in civilian districts of Baghdad, which was, in fact, where Saddam spent most of the war. The ensuing uproar of CNN carried the recovery of bodies live on worldwide television was sufficient to terminate all efforts to attack Saddam's administrative means of controlling the Iraqi population. When the Iraqi war was over, that administrative structure of redundant and ruthless secret police organizations, along with the remains of the Republican Guards, was sufficient to crush with enormous ruthlessness the revolutions that broke out among the Kurds in the north and the Shia in the south. The survival of Saddam's regime in the face of its catastrophic miscalculations and then defeats was partially the result of the inability of the coalition to attack even the administrative support structure of the Ba'ath tyranny. There's another irony in the reaction in the highest political levels in the United States to the Al-Firdaus bunker incident. Those killed in the bunker were from the families of the Iraqi leadership, those responsible for the ruthless imposition of Ba'ath tyranny. Yet at the same time that Western leadership was reacting so viscerally to the Al-Firdaus incident, coalition air forces were into the 26th day of blasting Iraqi forces in the Kuwaiti theater of operations. and they would continue that effort for another 2 weeks. Those Iraqi ground forces were for the most part conscripts drawn from the poorest elements in Iraqi society, and for the most part the victims rather than the perpetrators of the tyranny. And it would be from those that group that the revolution in southern Iraq would break out. And of course there was virtually no outcry about what was happening to them, and little recognition by those in charge of the air campaign that by completely wrecking the Iraqi ground forces, the coalition was in fact undermining the possibility of a successful revolution. Let me turn to the Kuwaiti theater of operations, where I think we see the third element that I identified at the beginning of this talk in terms of the focus of air forces on efficiency rather than effectiveness. The air war in the Kuwaiti theater of operations received relatively little attention from the planners throughout the pre-war period, and virtually no focus from the senior air leadership during the actual conduct of the war. That focus, for the most part, remained on the air campaign against Iraq. Nevertheless, there are a couple things we can identify in terms of which make rather interesting and instructive reading in terms of, it, we might say, the misapplication or the misthinking of the use of air power. The very beginning of planning for an attack on Iraqi forces in the Kuwaiti theater of operations, General Schwarzkopf had set a target of 50% of the deployed Iraqi tanks and artillery to be destroyed before a ground campaign would begin. What is fascinating is that the air commanders agreed to that 50% figure without even quarreling or suggesting that it might create some major problems. And in fact, it did, is very clear in terms of the record between the airmen and the ground commanders, that there was squabbling from that point to the end of the war and into the subsequent post-war period when the budgets began, the budget quarrels began to appear on the table. Because there was only sort of the most general aim of attriting the tanks and artillery of Saddam's forces, including Republican Guards, the Kuwaiti theater of operations was divided into a series of what were called kill boxes. And then aircraft were funneled into each kill box on the basis of what intelligence thought was in the kill box. And for a 40-day period, I think the kindest way of putting it is one sees a racking up of sorties, huge amounts of bombs dropped all over the landscape, for the most part by aircraft which did not possess precision guided munitions, including, I think, the most interesting case of all, which we'll come back to in a minute, the B-52s, which not only did not possess precision guided munitions, but in fact had put the wrong grid coordinates into their computers so that they were all bombed for 35 days of the war, 600 yards to the rear, and left. And finally, an intelligence observer noted that there seemed to be a pattern here, that the 8,000 B-52 strikes had all been 600 yards to the rear of what they were supposed to bomb, and maybe there was, in fact, something that could be done about it. Last 3 or 4 days, that problem was kind of fixed. In effect, then, until early February, when F-111Fs with precision-guided munitions capabilities were brought into the theater, the best we can say about the attacks on the Iraqi ground forces was that we dropped a huge number of bombs, which may have killed the odd unlucky Iraqi, may have destroyed the odd unlucky piece of artillery, but undoubtedly scared the hell out of large numbers of people, Iraqi soldiers throughout the area. Only in early February, with precision-guided munitions, did in fact the United States Air Force begin to destroy large amounts of equipment. Initially, an F-111 air crewman in a briefing before Schwarzkopf mentioned that the air crews were calling this tank plinking. Schwarzkopf then gave an order that Air Force pilots were no longer to use this term, which ensured that the United States Air Force will always use this term. Now began a steady attrition of Iraqi equipment, which has, of course, resulted in huge arguments within the American services as to whether 20%, 30%, 40%, or 50%, depending, of course, where you were poised in the budget arguments which are going on right now, of Iraqi equipment were destroyed. The irony, of course, is that toting up numbers of pieces of equipment is entirely irrelevant, just the way in terms of Bomber Harris is toting up the number of German cities destroyed and the number of German cities remaining to be attacked was irrelevant. What mattered, what really mattered, of course, was the mind of the Iraqi soldiers. In fact, if you destroyed 90% of the equipment and the Iraqi soldiers turned out to be the way the intelligence, American intelligence organizations estimated, the equivalent of the Waffen-SS, then you were going to have a very nasty couple of days in fighting through them. If, in fact, they turned out to be what they did, then, in fact, you could have destroyed no military equipment and you would have had a relatively easy ground campaign. What I think underlines this is the fact that, having read through a substantial portion of the prisoner of war interrogations which took place after the war, is that virtually every single Iraqi interviewed said that it was the B-52s, who never hit anything, that wrecked his morale across the board. And in fact, this weapon, which hit nothing, was in fact the most effective weapon of the war. Let me sum up by sort of underlining, if you will, sort of the three areas and themes which I think run through this war as they have through all previous wars. First of all is the fact that air forces, the United States Air Force, I should perhaps not pick on the RAF because undoubtedly a better organization in this respect. Most RAF officers have heard of the Battle of Britain. The United States Air Force is now busily engaged in taking General LeMay's name off of all of the suites because it might offend somebody in the Pacific who shall remain nameless. First of all is the general belief that past history had nothing to say in thinking about the kind of air campaign which we might or might not have wanted to launch in the Gulf in 1990-1991. Let me assure you, having served on the Gulf War Air Force Survey, an independent organization set up by the Secretary of the Air Force, because the Air Force had no interest in studying the war, that the Air Force had made major effort to bury that survey because it did not tell, quote, the Air Force story. So again, I have no illusions that we may well fully be able to repeat every mistake we made in the Gulf War. Second of all is the free lunch syndrome. In discussion with my colleague Robert Boyce, who suggested that perhaps wasn't I really suggesting that a more effective air campaign with more deeper thinking in it might have been able to politically cause the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, I had to suggest that, in fact, that's what I did not want to suggest. That, in fact, a very highly effective, highly articulated air campaign against Saddam Hussein's regime might very well not have resulted in his overthrow. But guaranteed that the old way of doing it and sort of believing that air war will allow you to easily attack the political heart of an enemy nation is a guaranteed way to ensure that you will not achieve any kind of popular collapse and the replacement of a regime like Saddam Hussein's. Third is the irrelevancy of numbers as a military historian, having looked at the long list of battles in which the numbers simply don't matter. What matters is in the heads of the soldiers and in the heads of the national leadership. I find it rather depressing, once again, to see the United States Air Force marching off in the Gulf War in a belief that simply racking up targets and starting with number one and working one's way through to number 3,262 in terms of tanks, or if you want to attack cities, you start off alphabetically with A and work your way through to Z, and when you have reached Z, then obviously you have won the war. Let me end there, and I'll be happy to take any questions. Thank you very much.
Questions, yes.
I think, yes. I mean, in fact, and of course, to think that one can influence the Serbs by taking down a few bridges or blowing up one or two ammunition dumps is bizarre if one knows any history of the region. But again, the United States Air Force, I can assure you, is an organization that knows nothing about the Balkans in terms of its history. But the larger point is, I think American policymakers have drawn, I think certainly the media has drawn, that air power provides what we might call, we Americans call, a free lunch syndrome, that it's an easy, simple way to address a nightmare. Now, of course, we might look at it somewhat differently if we had American ground troops involved in the United Nations efforts there. In fact, if we were to bring any order there, ground troops are the only way to do that. And of course, we have the German example of 20-plus divisions, which didn't bring a great deal of order there in the 42, 43, and 44 period. So, yes, and I think in terms of creating a tar baby and a simplistic belief that we can simply solve it with, I don't know, 100, 200, 300 airstrikes, very dangerous, very dangerous.
Yes, yes.
And I think the Europeans are quite correctly have been quite suspicious of that belief. Yes.
What struck me, what you said, was extremely interesting, I've heard that a lot, is the fact the selectivity of the bombing. You go from A through to Z and back again. You lift up Saddam Hussein's hometown, his home area, Tahiti, that whole area. They're hardly touched, as far as I know, the petrochem industry. They could have done that.
Well, some interesting comments in terms of the planning of that as to why that occurred. The reason that the Tikrit area was not attacked was for fear of civilian casualties, and that was a major theme in the air campaign, with I think some considerable justification, that the Western world would not accept the idea. And again, we have seen this in the American reaction to Saddam's effort to blow up ex-President Bush in Kuwait. We fired some cruise missiles at the Iraqi organization responsible for that idiocy. We fired them at night. The irony, of course, is the only people probably working in the building at night are cleaning ladies. But you won't get much CNN time with the two or three cleaning ladies. If we'd hit it in the daytime and you bring out large numbers of civilian criminals from the whichever secret police organization it was, and I don't know, on TV they still look like dead civilians, or they looked like dead civilians, which in terms of the Iraqi regime, that's really pushing it. But this limitation of targets like Tikrit very much had this in mind. The reason they didn't take out the petrochemical was this belief that Saddam was going to be replaced by many of the people planning the air campaign by a suitable general who would be, had obviously graduated from the command and staff college in Leavenworth, be friendly to America, understand what Iraq's proper role in the world should be, and therefore we wanted to leave a substantial portion of the economic infrastructure in place. And if you took out all the oil, then Iraq is going to have a very difficult time. That's why they went for the electricity. And a substantial portion of the early attacks on electricity were on transformers and things that could be repaired easily. The difficulty was that they kept attacking them because the people looking at damage assessment, when a transformer is shorted out by carbon filament wires, which cruise missiles were using, the evidence is non-existent. And so they kept sending people back to attack the transformers. And a number of the squadrons decided that maybe generator halls were more intelligent, even a target, even though the people up above. So we hit some generator halls later in the campaign. But the belief was that this was, we were trying to create the post-war friendly Iraq as a result of our, and of course we didn't.
Yes.
I hope that explains. Well, this collateral damage was precisely what we were trying to avoid. I mean, and it, I think it is instructive that just the collateral damage of the Al-Firdaus bunker was sufficient to end, for the rest of the air campaign, all attacks on the bunkers and command and control secret police headquarters, which were, quote, had civilians in them rather than military. Now, again, I'm not entirely convinced, given how effective and redundant this regime was in terms of whether it would have worked. But what we did try was a non-starter. When the war was over, the regime's political infrastructure was in place, particularly in the center, and it had sufficient military power to ensure that particularly the Shia in the south were crushed.
Donald.
I'm interested in your comment that the winning the battle of history as for their version of it was an important element in the budgetary struggle on an annual basis. They still have spent more, they haven't had a federal branch, they still is a better run and a larger share of budget than the equivalent army and navy federal branch here. But there was a very strong ideological battle over the first volume of the Cabinet Office History on the strategic bombing offensive in Britain. I remember attending a reception at the Royal United Services Institute, at which the junior author of that book, senior was the then Stevens professor at the Institute, was the junior one, and returning RAF officer, was condemned in terms which were reminiscent of the
It's a very complex story, and let me put a few
In terms of the Air Force Academy, which is where, for example, the Army's West Point has had a significant influence over the United States Army by its military history for the last 20, 25 years. A substantial number of senior Army generals actually got their MAs in military history and taught at the at West Point. There was a period of about 10 years where that was true of the Air Force in the early years, and one of the individuals who was out there as a British exchange officer, there was a 10-year period where the same thing was going on in the United States Air Force in terms of an extraordinary group of very bright officers, including one of them who is now the current Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force, were brought in, taught military history, I think had their horizons significantly expanded, and then sent back out to the structure. That ended for a variety of reasons in the early 1970s. Unfortunately, the department there has become very much more of a marginalized institution as opposed to the West Point, and one interested in history rather than serious Air Force history. Now, in terms of the Air Force official history program, that also has had an up and down course. During the 1980s and early 1990s, it was led by a first-rate American historian who had nothing to do with writing air power history before, but who was a magnificent politician, which I think anybody in that kind of position, if you want to influence a structure, a wonderful politician, and a man who believed that you could do official history and be honest about the history you're writing about. The difficulty is that before him that was not the case, and he has been replaced, by an individual who feels the exact opposite. In fact, when the Air Force, when the Air Power, Gulf War Air Power Survey first appeared, the present chief historian of the Air Force wrote a memorandum for the Air Force suggesting that this be suppressed because it might cause the same kind of trouble for the Air Force that the Strategic Bombing Survey had caused the Air Force in earlier decades. In other words, it was not a panegyric. Let's get rid of it. We don't need it. That kind of approach to history, which I think is how a substantial portion of the American senior Air Force leadership, not all, but a substantial portion, is very dangerous for an organization because you don't learn from your mistakes. That, at least, is my impression right now as to what's going on.
We have time for one more. Yes.
One target, which is absolutely tailor-made for air power, is a lie. ammunition way away from the civilian population. And this, in my mind, explains the desperate response of the taking a large scale of taking hostages. But that's an alternative view. The question is one, to me, very significant fact you've missed in your necessarily abbreviated survey of the antecedents of the Gulf air campaign. With a bitter disagreement within the United States Air Force itself about Tarzan, whether in fact the Warden plan should be adopted, or whether a much more tri-service tactical combat-oriented campaign should be launched. And as I know you know, there was considerable development in Harvard. Can you say that in your own terms, offers a little bit of hope for the future of the United States Air Force?
Well, I discussed some of that. I think what's interesting, and I'm very ambivalent about John Warden. I think that, from my point of view, in some ways, he is just simply regurgitating some ideas which we should have thought through a long time ago. On the other hand, John Warden is a man who actually believes in intellectual debate. Since I've argued with these, I worked for him as a reserve officer for 4 years and argued with him, tried to say, no, this can't be right, and that never hurt my position in terms of my reserve position. I think the difficulty is that what worked well in this war, and I didn't have a chance either in the paper or in my book, which is sort of comes out of the Gulf War Air Power Survey where I did the operations volume. You're right, that in fact there was a very serious debate, and that in fact, whatever the defects in Warden's approach, there was a coherent and a focus and attempt to say why, what are we doing and why do we want to do it. And I think there were a lot of assumptions that were very weak there, the idea that you could influence Saddam's regime, but there were ideas out on the table. Whereas in fact what I found very dangerous in the organization, and I think they could do this the next time, is there were a substantial number of people who basically wanted to line up the targets, start with A and work your way through to Z, and that would solve the problem. Missing the fact that a campaign might last 6 days, it might last 12, it might last 40 days. Nobody knew what the ambiguities involved were. I think what worked particularly well, I came to respect Horner more and more, because Horner was a crusty, nasty old individual who was, could be excruciatingly rude to people, could also be wonderful to people, but who, when he saw Warden's plan, said to Warden, what happens if they're still around a day 7 and we're out of ammunition? And basically blew Warden out. But when Warden left at the end of August of 1990, Horner clearly saw that he needed something more than just simply the way the boys from 9th Air Force were doing, and that there had to be some sort of approach. I don't think they got it completely right. Again, I think the difficulty that all of us historians impose on the record is that it's so easy in retrospect to look back and see what worked and what didn't work. Now, in fact, of course, our suggestions, we don't know whether they would have worked or not worked, because the thing was played out differently. And in fact, I think we miss how, first of all, the pressures these guys were under, working 14, 15, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. And how difficult it was to think through problems that were not open to, I think, even long-term easy solution. I think what worries me is that, in fact, instead of sitting back and looking at this war and saying, boy, we really got to do some substantive thinking about can we do A, B, or C, that, in fact, there are a great majority of Air Force officers and certainly senior officers who believe Douay, Mitchell, and Trenchard were proven correct, and we can go in and do it easily. You're right. We undoubtedly, hitting the Serb ammunition dumps has had a quite obvious major impact on them, because I think even they understand this is very, very bad behavior. But I'm not sure this is going to get them to do what we want them to do. This is a group of people who, you know, survived the Ottoman Turks. We ain't close to the Ottoman Turks. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. And on behalf of your audience, can I just say how pleased we are, even though we're diminished by the exigencies of exams and the state of term, that you could bring this insight to the school. I must say, listening to you, I do hope that we remember to this distinction between effectiveness and efficiency, because what little I saw of military procurement, and when you think of the billions of pounds and dollars and marks and francs we spend on these toys, and do not ask the simplest questions, which, for example, we are asking of universities about are you effective or are you efficient, I do wonder whether there's not more that a school of the social sciences might not do. However, that aside, thank you very much.